or construction. The Pacific Railroad Act of 1862 enabled the Union Pacific to lay rails westward from Omaha, while the Central Pacific started in Sacramento and headed east. Congress put ridiculous incentives into the legislation. Benefits given to the railroads that right-thinking legislators should have known would breed corruption on a massive scale. For example, the railroads received 20 alternating sections of federal land and, in addition, received a staggering series of cash loans for each mile of track constructed. $16,000 for flat land, $32,000 for hilly terrain, and $48,000 in mountains. Naturally, the railroads had a stake in laying as much track on as much difficult terrain as was humanly possible. Historian Burton Folsom Jr. summarized how Congress's misincentives shaped the railroad company's strategy. They sometimes built winding, circuitous roads to collect for more mileage. They used cheap and light wrought iron rails, soon to be outmoded by Bessemer rails. The Union Pacific's vice president, Thomas Durant, complained to his staff members, "You are doing too much masonry. Substitute wooden culverts for masonry whenever you can." They used fragile cottonwood trees because they were handy, stealing farmers' timber with the reasoning that it was public land anyway. With government dollars backing the railroad's every move, who could argue otherwise? Moreover, the railroads also meandered in search of mineral rights, leading the Northern Pacific through the Black Hills of South Dakota and fomenting the Sioux Wars. Union Pacific's chief engineer, Granville Dodge, laid track on ice, and the whole line had to be rebuilt in the spring. Crossing unsettled land invited Indian attacks, requiring that half the workers at any site stand guard while the other half worked. Climaxing the wasteful affair, when the Union Pacific and Central Pacific came within the vicinity of each other, work crews began gang fights and built parallel lines as long as Congress tolerated it. Finally, even the federal government had enough, and lawmakers demanded that the two lines link up. The subsidized transcontinentals linked the nation only after phenomenal waste, a task James J. Hill later did without federal aid. This is no small point. It would become common fare in the 20th century to point to the transcontinental railroads as an effective example of government's involvement in supporting industries or companies that it had picked as desirable. Yet even the subsequent transcontinental railroads that received government support, such as Henry Villard's Northern Pacific, all failed or had to be reorganized in the Panic of 1893. Only Hill's free market line survived intact because it was built with profit, not subsidies, in mind. Even as the Golden Spike was being driven, both railroads were already planning to rebuild and even relocate the track to cover the shoddy construction. It was 1874 before the Union Pacific finished fixing the new track it laid 5 years before. The Credit Mobilier scandal had its roots in this perfidious use of government money. The corruption was brought into the open because the company was formed in 1864 solely as a means to prop up the sinking Union Pacific stock. The congressional charter required the railroad to sell its stock for cash at $100 par value, but the price sank almost immediately upon issue as investors questioned whether the railroad could even be built. Thomas Durant came up with the concept of forming a new credit arm, Credit Mobilier, whose stockholders were identical to the Union Pacific's. Under the scheme, the railroad would give construction contracts to Credit Mobilier, which then would balloon the costs of construction to double the genuine expenses. Union Pacific paid Credit Mobilier with its own checks, which the directors of the credit company promptly used to purchase railroad stock at the par value of $100 per share. Looked at another way, Durant had managed to get the railroad to buy its own stock. He then had Credit Mobilier sell the stock on the open market far below par. The scam, while convoluted, nevertheless boiled down to Durant's giving stockholders profits from sales of Union Pacific stock on the open market, which had been sanitized up to par value by washing it through the Credit Mobilier laundry. In the process, the directors and stockholders of Credit Mobilier had made outrageous profits from the overbilling of the railroad, all funded by Uncle Sam's land grants and loans, and had also made profits from the resale of the watered stock. As if those gains were not enough, a number of congressmen, James A. Garfield of Ohio and James Brooks of New York, senators, James Patterson of New Jersey, and Grant administration officials, including the vice president, Schuyler Colfax, were given generous Credit Mobilier holdings to ensure they did not turn off the money spigot. Scholars estimate that the corrupt directors and congressmen skimmed between $13 million and $23 million from the Union Pacific through Credit Mobilier, which was finally exposed by the reporting of Charles Dana's New York Sun in 1872. Once again, Grant was not directly implicated, but could not escape guilt by inference. Other scandals quickly followed, including the Whiskey Ring, the Veterans Administration scandal, and the exposure of Secretary of War William W. Belknap for accepting bribes in return for the sale of Indian trading posts. Grant's reputation suffered further blows. Missing in the moralizing of both the pundits of the day and subsequent historians is the key issue. Such corruption tracked precisely with the vast expansion of the federal bureaucracy. People acted no better or worse in the 1870s than they had in George Washington's day. What had changed, however, was that the opportunity for graft combined with the incredible profits to be gained from corruption, causing one historian to label this the era of good stealings. This malignancy owed much of its existence to the growth of government. Scandals in the Grant era turned the liberal critique of the Gilded Age on its head. Far from the laissez-faire capitalism necessitating government regulation, it was an orgy of government intervention that caused the corruption and fed it. The best reform Americans could have enacted in the decade after Grant would have been to roll back to antebellum levels the subsidies, benefits, tariffs, and favorable land grants to railroads and other bonuses given to special interests. Yet the reformers learned precisely the wrong lessons from these events. Re-election and reform. The demise of the Democratic Party's Tweed Ring, run by boss William Marcy Tweed, an organization that honed graft in New York to a high art by providing kickback and pocket lining to friendly politicians, convinced many politicians in each party that not only should something be done about political corruption, but that reform measures could also be successful. The accelerating calls for political reform came as a reaction against the radicals, and they were led by another faction of Republicans, the liberals. These liberals included Carl Schurz, Horace Greeley, Gideon Welles, Charles Francis Adams, and editor E.L. Godkin, who favored free trade, redeeming greenbacks in gold, a stable currency, restoring the former Confederates their rights, and civil service reform. Schurz won a Senate seat in 1872, demonstrating that the liberals had some electoral clout and leading them to test their might in 1872, when they held a separate convention. Their emergence says something about the difficulty of applying labels in historical settings. The liberals, like the conservative Southern Democrats, opposed further Reconstruction measures, and both were opposed by the radical Republicans. However, the radicals, like most Democrats, favored a continuation of the spoils system, which the liberals wanted to end. Former conservative hard-money Democrats, after the Civil War, slowly embraced inflation and spoke favorably of greenbacks, a tool the Union government had used to win the war. Finally, liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats both supported free trade and ending tariffs, but radicals did not. Judging from these issues alone, any attempt to consistently apply 20th and 21st century name tags to 19th century politics is an exercise in futility. But while the liberals relished their name, they overestimated their importance. At their 1872 Cincinnati convention, they nominated Horace Greeley, 1811-72, editor of the New York Tribune. Greeley's true passion was reform. He embraced every reform idea that came down the pike, and not surprisingly, employed Karl Marx as his European correspondent. In the 1840s, Greeley championed socialistic Fourierism, but finding that a political dead end, he turned to patronage and spoils, always an intelligent choice for a publisher. Alcohol, tobacco, prostitution, and gambling all earned the scornful ink of Greeley's pen. During the Mexican War, he had urged, "Sign anything, ratify anything, pay anything. There was never a good war or a bad peace." He seemed to have changed his view 20 years later. On to Richmond! Crush the rebels in blood and fire! In 1865, the mutable Greeley contributed to the bail of Confederate President Jefferson Davis. Still, the opportunities for Democrats to ally with liberal Republicans forced them to hand their nomination to Greeley, who was the only person of either party they thought might unseat Grant. Had nothing unusual occurred, Greeley still would have lost the election convincingly. As it was, his wife's health deteriorated, and he judged her mentally insane. She died in the last moments of the election, essentially taking Horace with her. He had a mental or emotional breakdown and expired in an asylum 3 weeks after her demise. Meanwhile, the attacks on him by the Grant forces had been so relentlessly effective that even Greeley quipped he did not know if he was running for the presidency or the penitentiary. Portrayed as a crank and a disunionist and connected by Thomas Nast to the Tweed Ring, Greeley actually accomplished something of a miracle by garnering 44% of the vote and 60 electoral votes. Grant smashed him with almost 300 electoral votes and beat him by 750,000 in the popular vote. Still, the campaign planted an important seed. Liberals started to redefine the Republican Party as the party of free trade, less government, low taxes, sound money, and the necessity for character in government. Within 50 years, a Republican presidential candidate, Warren Harding, stood for less government, lower taxes, and sound money. And in another half century, Ronald Reagan embraced every one of the 1870s liberal positions. Meanwhile, the radical Reconstruction program was unraveling rapidly. Democrats had not only driven out most of their number who might work for black rights, but they had also embraced former Confederates with open arms. "Virginia for the Virginians" was the campaign slogan of former Confederate general and Gettysburg veteran James L. Kemper in 1873, employing a phrase that clearly implied African Americans were not Virginians. "To save the state," said one of his lieutenants, "we must make the issue white and black race against race and the canvas red hot." Italics added. To be sure, not all Southerners tolerated race baiting, and many of the leading Southern newspapers sharply criticized establishing a color line in elections. But these were pragmatic responses by editors fearful that playing the race card would only lead to more Republican victories and seldom reflected any genuine concern for blacks or their rights. The revival of such attitudes emboldened the Klan, whose activities increased in number and viciousness. Violence by the Klan and other terror organizations prompted a response from Congress, which Grant wholeheartedly supported. In May 1870, under the authority of the 15th Amendment, Congress passed the first Force Act. Since the object of the legislation was to end intimidation by the Klan, this and similar acts were also called the Ku Klux Acts. The Force Act provided heavy fines and imprisonment for anyone attempting to hinder citizens from voting. Congress reinforced the act in 1871 and then in 1872 passed legislation even more specific in its language aimed at the Klan. Threatening or injuring witnesses, interfering with federal officers, or even going about in disguises were all prohibited. The Klansmen and their terrorist allies did not go quietly. They staged massive torchlight parades, shot at Republican offices, lynched blacks, and bullied African Americans into staying home on election day. A few blacks tried to form rifle companies to counteract the Klan, but they had little training with firearms and few weapons. Grant managed to effectively drive the Klan underground for almost a generation, but it skulked in the background, awaiting an administration in Washington less committed to black rights. By 1870, the Fusion Loyalist Democrats were strongly opposed by Redeemers or Bourbons. Their politicians were planters and former Confederates like Kemper, who were determined to end black Reconstruction. Although they also had genuine concerns for the economic collapse of their states under the radical governments, their three main issues were race, race, and race. Redeemers found a wide audience for disenfranchising blacks. "Give us a convention," intoned Robert Toombs, "and I will fix it so that the people shall rule, and the Negro shall never be heard from." Opposition to the state debts, government support for business, and other Whiggish programs also played a crucial role in the Redeemers' success. Indeed, when the Bourbons got control, they did not merely reduce the debts and pay them off over time, they repudiated them. Whether the Redeemers fully realized they were helping to condemn the South to decades more of poverty is unclear, but that certainly was the result of their policies. Repudiating debts was a sure way to guarantee no one lent Southern governments money again, and guilt by association meant that any Southern-originated bonds by even private companies would be viewed with suspicion. Or, as Reconstruction historian Michael Perman observed, because it was fiscally untrustworthy and financially dependent, the South had, in effect, surrendered control over its future economic development. Whereas the state-subsidized model of railroad and corporate support, often advanced by the Whigs and Republicans, proved disadvantageous, if not disastrous, to transportation and industrial progress, the Democrats' punitive redistributionist policies, little more than financial bulimia and anorexia, were equally dim-witted. The South, already bereft of railroads, banks, and manufacturing, turned to the Redeemers, who offered the region a politics of balance, inertia, and drift. The Panic of 1873 provided the final electoral issue, allowing the Democratic Redeemers to win back control of most Southern state houses in the 1874 election, and, amazingly, for the first time since 1858, Democrats won the U.S. House of Representatives. Empowered at last, Redeemers had no intention of enforcing federal civil rights laws. Just the opposite. They supported segregation statutes known as Jim Crow laws. Interestingly, by the 1870s, the free market had already made some inroads toward ending segregation when streetcars were integrated. It was government, not business, which wanted the profits from black ridership that insisted on segregating streetcars and other public facilities. With the combination of a waning federal will to enforce civil rights legislation, the return of the Redeemers, and the revival of the Klan, freedmen saw much of what they had gained in the decade after the Civil War slip away. Diversions. Americans, especially Northern Americans, had grown increasingly weary of defending black rights and their own corrupt Reconstruction governments in the South. Less than a decade after armies marched singing, "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord," Northerners wanted to know when the Lord would show up and release them from the burden of policing their white Southern neighbors. When the Republicans lost the midterm election in 1874, it indicated support for Reconstruction was waning. Political realities of the 1870s combined to push Republicans further away from their radical Reconstruction goals of union, emancipation, and equality, until by 1876, three of these had been reduced to two: union and emancipation. Equality had been discarded. Events in the frontier West distracted Americans as well. The Indian Wars commanded tremendous political and humanitarian energy, once solely reserved for the Negro. Reformers, having finished their work in the South, brushed themselves off and turned their attention to another helpless group, Native Americans. Indians had suffered a constant string of broken treaties, as discussed in the next chapter. Few episodes, however, shook the nation as much as the news of June 1876, when an alliance of Sioux and Cheyenne, once hated enemies, produced the worst military disaster on the Western Plains, the destruction of a large portion of Colonel George Custer's 7th U.S. Cavalry. If troops were needed in the West, they had to come from the South, weakening enforcement of open polls and control over the Klan. Economic disruption also drew attention from the South. The failure of Jay Cook's banking house in 1873, brought about in part by his reliance on Union Pacific Railroad bonds, touched off the panic of 1873. That same year, the government announced it would redeem the greenbacks in gold beginning in 1879, a policy that was in no way connected with Cook's failure, and at the same time, Washington announced that it would not monetize silver. Consistent with the liberals' position of sound money, the government had refused to inflate the currency, instigating yet another howl of protest from Western farmers, miners, and others who were caught in the post-war deflation, itself of international origins. With each Union Army regiment redeployed to the West, Republican voters in the South lost a little more security. Blacks and whites alike feared for their lives as they went to the polls, which they did with less and less frequency. As a Mississippi carpetbagger governor wrote to his wife, "The Republicans are paralyzed through fear and will not act. Why should I fight a hopeless battle when no possible good to the Negro or anybody else would result?" A Northern Republican echoed the frustration. "The truth is, our people are tired out with the worn-out cry of Southern outrages. Hard times and heavy taxes make them wish the everlasting nigger were in hell or Africa." Democrats and Southerners had learned an important lesson about the press. No matter how grievous the charge, deny it. Then commit another wanton act, and the first behavior will be forgotten in the storm over the new one. Northern newspapers unwittingly assisted in the unraveling of Reconstruction, portraying black legislators as hopelessly corrupt. Thieves, orgies, plunder. Words like these characterized reporting about the Reconstruction governments. The first sign of surrender appeared in May 1872, when Congress passed the Amnesty Act, allowing Confederate leaders to vote and hold public office. When Southern Republicans, already disenchanted with the potential for full social equality of blacks, began to desert the party, the Reconstruction government truly became ruled by a foreign power. Democrats, having inflated Confederate currency into worthlessness and acquiesced in a government that essentially imposed a 100% tax on its citizens, now skillfully and disingenuously accused the black Republicans of excessive spending and overtaxation. As a last-gasp attempt to show its commitment, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1875, a final bill pushed through the Republican-controlled lame duck Congress, guaranteeing full and equal treatment to all persons of every race and decreeing access to all public facilities such as hotels, theaters, and railroads. As usual, enforcement relied on troops, and the troops had been pulled out of every southern state except Louisiana, Florida, and South Carolina. Elsewhere, Redeemer governments had crept back in, one at a time, beginning with Tennessee in 1869, West Virginia, Missouri, and North Carolina in 1870, Georgia in 1871, Alabama, Texas, and Arkansas in 1874, and Mississippi in 1875. What the North did, for understandable reasons, was to abandon what it started. What the South did, also for understandable reasons, was to attempt to return to its antebellum social and economic structure, sans the legal institution of slavery. For Reconstruction to have worked, as many had hoped, it would have required a view of government exactly opposite of the large central behemoth that had undermined the Confederacy. It needed small, morally impeccable, and utterly efficient state governments. It needed low taxes at the state level and abolition of those state or local regulations that gave any group advantages over another. It also required a massive infusion of banking capital, which the National Bank Acts had failed to provide. Finally, it probably would have required another leader with the genius and compassion of Lincoln to pull it off. Yet even in the greatest republic on earth, a Lincoln only comes around once a generation at best. Instead of a great leader like Lincoln, the nation's next president was a good, honest, and competent leader named Rutherford B. Hayes. Rutherford B. Hayes, soldier and politician. Like his predecessor, Ulysses Grant, Rutherford B. Hayes knew combat well. During the Civil War, he had been wounded 5 times and had 4 horses shot out from under him. He narrowly missed being kidnapped by Confederate raiders who absconded with Union generals George Crook and Benjamin Franklin Kelly, then spearheaded the effort to get them back. William McKinley said of Hayes that his whole nature seemed to change when in battle. He went from sunny, agreeable, the kind, generous, the gentle gentleman, to intense and ferocious. Hayes's first cousin was utopian John Humphrey Noyes, but Hayes shared none of his eccentric brand of socialism, preferring instead traditional marriage and sound capitalism. When the war ended, he had second thoughts about politics, but was, after all, a veteran and a good speaker. So much so that by the end of October 1866, he could leave his own congressional political campaigning and work to secure the election of John Sherman as an Ohio senator. An ardent champion of securing the rights of the freedmen, Congressman Hayes realized that only the federal government, and with Andrew Johnson in the White House at the time, only Congress, protected the new citizens. He wrote to his wife Lucy about a parade celebrating the end of the war in April 1866, in which the colored procession marched in Washington with flags and bands, their cheering for the House and Senate as they passed the east front of the Capitol was peculiarly enthusiastic. After his short stint in Congress, Hayes, waving the bloody shirt, won the gubernatorial seat in Ohio in 1867, only to find that many issues that once were the domain of state governments had been taken over by Washington. Hayes intended to emphasize black voting rights, but otherwise hoped the legislature would pass few laws. Winning a second term in 1870, Hayes especially worked to curb local taxes, which had risen 5 times faster in Ohio than state taxes, and sought to further reduce state indebtedness. The legislature still spent more than he requested, but Hayes managed to reduce the rate of growth, at the same time supporting increased spending on the state orphans' home, education, and penal reform. In 1872, thinking he had retired from politics, Hayes moved back to Cincinnati, where he actively criticized Republican corruption. Called out of retirement to unite a deeply divided party, Hayes won the governorship again in mid-1876, despite a bad economy that worked against the party in power, the Republicans. No sooner had Hayes won, however, than Senator John Sherman and General Philip Sheridan both urged him to run for the presidency. Sheridan wrote Hayes endorsing his own preference for a ticket of Hayes and Wheeler, to which Hayes remarked to his wife, "I am ashamed to say, but who is Wheeler?" Wheeler was Congressman William A. Wheeler of New York, and the Republican convention, as fortune would have it, took place in Cincinnati, where many of the Hayes men had already infiltrated the party apparatus. Even without such inside activity, however, Hayes won support because his opponents, including Roscoe Boss Conkling of New York and James G. Blaine of Maine, all had significant flaws. In the general election, GOP nominee Hayes squared off against New York Democratic Governor Samuel J. Tilden, who had gained a reputation by crushing the infamous Tweed Ring. After seeing early returns showing Tilden carrying Indiana and New York, Hayes went to bed and slept soundly, convinced he had lost the election. But the far West, including Oregon, California, and Nevada, was late to report, and all went for Hayes. In addition, there were troubling results in three southern states, Louisiana, South Carolina, and Florida. If Hayes carried all of them, he would win by one electoral vote, even though the final popular vote showed him losing by almost 250,000 votes, a whopping 3% Tilden victory in ballots cast. Yet local voting boards retained the authority to determine which ballots were valid and which were fraudulent, although he was convinced the Democrats had engaged in massive vote manipulation. Hayes nevertheless hesitated to contest the election. What sealed the matter for him was the perception that virtually all of the fraud had been perpetrated against African Americans, whose rights Hayes had fought for, almost to the exclusion of anything else, his entire political career. As with Al Gore and George W. Bush under similar circumstances more than a century later, Tilden and Hayes engaged in the game of attempting to look presidential while their subordinates hotly contested the results. Like Gore and Bush, both men were convinced that a legitimate canvass would favor their chances. Hayes appeared to have carried South Carolina by 1,000 votes, despite the rulings from local boards there. But he had also lost Louisiana by 6 times that many ballots, constituting a significant challenge to his contest claim. In Florida, repeaters, ballot stuffers, and other tricksters, including those who had printed Democratic ballots with the Republican symbol on them to deceive illiterate voters, made it all but impossible to determine the true winner. Hayes probably won South Carolina and Florida, but Tilden carried Louisiana, where Republican vote tampering was probably quite high, and that was all he needed. Hayes insisted that, "We are not to allow our friends to defeat one outrage and fraud by another," and demanded, "There must be nothing crooked on our part." Matters had already spun out of his control, however. The returning board in Louisiana, which was all Republican and under the supervision of J. Madison Wells, who was clearly engaged in post-election scheming for patronage, tossed out 15,000 total ballots, of which 13,000 were Democratic, giving Hayes the state by 3,000 votes. Florida's board included a Democrat, but the result was the same. Hayes won the state by 900 votes. Hayes also took the disputed South Carolina votes, giving him ostensibly 185 electoral votes to Tilden's 184, and, in turn, giving him the election. The affair dragged on into the new year, and, as provided for by the Constitution, Congress had to clean up the matter. In the interim, Hayes's forces received feelers from some Southern congressmen who floated the trial balloon of receiving consideration in return for their support of Hayes, meaning federal subsidies for the Texas and Pacific Railroad, an end to military occupation, and plenty of patronage. Congress settled on a 15-member commission made up of 5 senators, 5 congressmen, and 5 Supreme Court justices. Each party would have 7 members, plus, ostensibly, 1 independent, Justice David Davis. Everyone recognized that, barring a miracle, Davis would determine the election. But it was the only practical solution, and both Hayes and Tilden reluctantly approved of the commission. Then, surprising everyone, Davis refused to serve on the commission. He thought he smelled a bribe and withdrew. By prior agreement, another Supreme Court justice had to serve, and it fell to Justice Joseph P. Bradley, a Republican, to take his place. As with the disputed election of 2000, there was controversy over whether to accept the official returns certified by the governor and the secretary of state, or to accept other unsanctioned returns. The Democrats claimed Florida had been stolen through Republican fraud, but historian James McPherson challenges such a contention. Voting on party lines, the commission accepted the official certified returns, and Florida went to Hayes. Similar 8-7 votes soon yielded to Hayes the Louisiana and South Carolina electors. While these maneuvers were occurring, representatives from Hayes and Tilden met at Washington's Wormley Hotel to settle the election. This backstage bargain, which many historians view as having produced the Compromise of 1877, was overblown. Hayes had already made it clear he would ensure the retention of the Democratic governor of Louisiana in return for a pledge on freedmen's rights, withdraw the remaining federal troops from Louisiana, Florida, and South Carolina, and put Southerners in the cabinet. Even without a bargain, the deal was sealed, and Hayes mollified Democrats and Southerners enough to avert violence. Nevertheless, historians tout the agreement at the Wormley Hotel on February 26, 1877, as the last great sectional compromise. On March 4, 1877, 4 months after the election, the nation had its new president. Hayes upheld his promise, naming a Democrat, David Key of Tennessee, as Postmaster General, which remained, it should be noted, a prize political plum. The circumstances of his victory dictated that Hayes faced almost insurmountable odds against achieving much. He had not only a divided country, but also a divided party and a divided Congress. Although the Senate remained in Republican hands, the House had gone back to the Democrats in 1874 as a response to the Panic of 1873. His administration had a late start thanks to the Tilden challenge, making it midsummer before the government even began to fill its primary positions. But most damaging, Hayes had stated that he would not run for a second term. Only through his insistence on a unified cabinet and an unwillingness to be bullied by the House did Hayes achieve as much as he did. Protection of blacks by the bayonet in the South had run its course, and with Indian troubles on the frontier, the army was stretched too thin to keep large numbers of troops in the South as civil rights enforcers. Withdrawal of federal troops commenced within a month, driven in part by pragmatism and in part by hope. Hope that the Southerners would understand that they had entered a new era. Instead, the close election and the subsequent compromise meant that the South now acted as if it had defeated the North's legislation, if not her armies. Chapter 11. Lighting Out for the Territories, 1861-90. Civilizing a Wilderness. Young Samuel Clemens, alias Mark Twain, gave up his brief career as a Mississippi steamboat pilot in 1861, setting out for the Nevada Territory aboard a stagecoach. Having tried his hand at gold and silver mining, he turned to newspaper work and a promising career as a writer. Clemens, in fact, moved west to escape the Civil War, a conflict in which he had served briefly and without distinction as a Confederate militiaman. He had no appetite for the kind of violence and devastation that consumed his fellow Missourians. Like his later literary character Huckleberry Finn, Sam Clemens lit out for the territories. Many had gone before him, and many more followed. The period of manifest destiny, followed quickly by the Mormon Exodus and the California Gold Rush of 1849, set the stage for a half century of migration by Eastern Americans onto and across the Great Plains. Clemens was preceded by tens of thousands of anonymous fur trappers, cowboys, prostitutes, loggers, fishermen, farmers, miners, teachers, entertainers, soldiers, government officials, and business entrepreneurs, in addition to Mormons, Jesuits, Methodists, and other missionaries. In the 1860s, while the Civil War raged back east, Clemens and a new generation headed west. In 1893, historian Frederick Jackson Turner wrote that this generation had succeeded so well that the American frontier had at last come to an end. In his brilliant essay, The Significance of the Frontier in American History, Turner traced the course of the westward movement from revolutionary times across the Appalachians and the Mississippi River. He pointed to the 1890 census report, stating matter-of-factly that Western America had achieved a density of population that rendered the term frontier inapplicable. Turner undoubtedly portrayed America's Western experience as unique. But how? Was Turner's thesis right? Turner used the 1890 census report as a watershed to assess the impact of the frontier experience on the American people. He rejected the idea that Europeans had molded American culture and argued that it was the American frontier experience that had created a unique American civilization, providing a safety valve for the release of societal pressures. He ascribed to the West and Westerners specific character traits, most of them positive, but some unsavory, arguing that the West made Americans democratic, egalitarian, nationalistic, pragmatic, and adaptive. Turner also contended that frontier life made them coarse, violent, anti-intellectual, and wasteful of natural resources. Yet even as he wrote, lumbermen like Frederick Weyerhaeuser, railroaders like James J. Hill, and meatpackers like Gustavus Swift had begun taking extraordinary measures to preserve the environment. And where Turner saw a violent, often barbaric West, the so-called Wild West may have been less violent in many respects than modern society. Most Western men were neither John Wayne types looking for a fight, nor helpless citizens waiting for a frontier hero to rescue them. In regions where judges rode a circuit and came to town with any luck once a month, there naturally existed a tendency to take law into one's own hands. Where every animal had its claw, horn, tooth, or sting, many of them potentially fatal, and where every human had an incentive to jump a claim, steal livestock, or become offended at the slightest insult, unnecessary violence literally went with the territory. Nor was the West a Marxist model of class struggle. For every saloon brawl that started over class interests, 50 began over simple insults or alcohol. On the other hand, frontier individualism was not ubiquitous, and Westerners could cooperate when necessary. Towns first united to bring the cattlemen in, then passed laws to keep them out. Then cattlemen joined the townspeople to keep the sheepmen out. Then ranchers and farmers of all types sought to keep heavy industry out. Nor were these patterns unique. A century later, it was the same story. Heavy industry sought to keep computers and electronics out. Those who settled the West for better and occasionally for worse tamed a wild frontier. They left a legacy of romantic accomplishment that even to the present contains important messages and images for Americans. Timeline: 1843, first large Oregon Trail wagon train. 1846-47, Mormon exodus to Utah. 1848, Mexican War ends, New Mexico Territory, California ceded to United States. 1849, gold discovered at Sutter's Mill, California gold rush begins. 1850, Compromise of 1850 admits California as a state. 1853, Gadsden Purchase completes map of lower continental United States. 1857, Butterfield Overland Stage provides passenger and mail route to California. 1859, Comstock load discovered. 1860, Pony Express begins operations. 1861, Civil War begins. 1862, Homestead Act, Morrill Act, Plains Indian Wars begin. 1864, Sand Creek Massacre. 1865-85, Cattle Kingdom reaches its apex. 1866, Fetterman Massacre. 1867, Grange Movement begins. 1869, Transcontinental Railroads join at Promontory, Utah. 1876, Custer Massacre. 1882, Edmonds Act. 1885, Chief Joseph and Nez Perce surrender. 1887, Dawes Severalty Act. 1890, Wounded Knee Massacre. 1893, Frederick Jackson Turner declares frontier closed. 1896, Alaskan Gold Rush. Wagon trains, stagecoaches, and steamboats. Before the completion of North America's first transcontinental railroad in 1869, westbound pioneers continued to use varied means of transport. Thousands drove wagons over well-worn, often muddy trails and helped break in some new ones. An era of private road building in the early eastern frontier areas gave way to a willingness to use the state and national government to improve transportation. Pony Express riders and horsemen traversed these trails, and travelers booked passage on stagecoaches. Members of the famed Mormon handcart brigades literally walked the trail west, pushing their belongings in front of them. Meanwhile, sailboats and steam-powered ocean vessels brought immigrants to the west via the coast of South America, and hard-working steamboats navigated rivers. Decades after the coming of the railroad, nearly all of the above routes and means of transport endured in one form or another. Although the settlers of the 1830s still used muskets, increasingly the Kentucky long rifle had come into use, extending range and accuracy. After the Civil War, breech-loading Sharps, Spencer, Winchester, and Remington rifles with repeating action were available. The first repeaters had appeared in the Civil War, and with minimal practice, a man or woman could squeeze off a dozen shots in less than 30 seconds. Many men carried sidearms, usually a Colt revolver, and knives or tomahawks or other weapons were always handy in case of snakes or predators. When combined with circled wagons for defense, settlers had a good chance of warding off Indian attacks with such weapons. The route north of the North Platte River became the Mormon Trail, blazed by the Mormon Exodus to Utah, 1846-47. Army engineers built or improved upon additional trails throughout the West, such as the Bozeman Trail, a supply route stretching north from Fort Laramie in present-day Wyoming to the Montana country. In Washington Territory, the Army built the 624-mile Mullen Road, named for its surveyor, Lieutenant John Mullen, between 1859 and 1862. Connecting Fort Benton, the head of the Missouri River steamboat navigation, to Fort Walla Walla near the navigable lower Columbia River, the Mullen Road was cut by the Army in order to transport troops and supplies. Soon, however, hundreds of miners, missionaries, entrepreneurs, and farmer immigrants cluttered the trail, turning it into a vital route for 1860s gold seekers bound for mines in the present-day states of Washington, Idaho, and western Montana. Stagecoaches were vital common carriers, commercial transporters of mail, freight, and passengers. Like many western businesses, stagecoach companies began small and then earned enough capital to become larger firms. Eastern coach companies, begun by Henry Wells, who ran a string of speech therapy schools in New York, John Butterfield, and William Fargo, became the basis of the famous modern firms American Express and Wells Fargo. The Butterfield line opened its southern route running through Texas to California in 1857. In 1860, the California Stage Company ran the 700-mile route between Portland, Oregon, and Sacramento, California, in an impressive 6 days. Beginning in 1852, Wells Fargo and Company, California Stage's famed competitor, offered service out of San Francisco to most of the West's mining districts. In 1862, Ben Holliday, the stagecoach king, briefly challenged Wells and Fargo before selling out to them in 1866, and then founded the Oregon Central Railroad. For a brief moment between the stagecoaches and the telegraph, the Pony Express filled the gap for rapid delivery of mail. Steamboats ran the Upper Missouri, Sacramento, Lower Columbia, and other western rivers throughout the years before the Civil War. From 1850 to 1860, a dozen small competitors vied to haul miners and supplies along the Columbia and Snake Rivers to Lewiston in present-day Idaho. Their tough, low-draft steamers symbolized a rough-and-ready era of independent rivermen who navigated around rocks, shoals, and numerous dangerous drift logs in swift currents, rapids, and falls. In 1860, the Oregon Steam Navigation Company bought them all out, controlling the trade with 26 steamers until 1880. During this time, the company built the Northwest's first railroad track, a mere 6 miles, to facilitate transshipment of steamboat cargoes around the Celilo Falls of the Columbia River. This little stretch of track marked the tender beginning of the western stretch of what would become the Northern Pacific Railroad. The Iron Horse Races West. American railroads had already started to undercut prices in river traffic by the Civil War. Railroads stretched into Missouri and Wisconsin, and construction continued westward after the war. Most students of history are familiar with the subsidized transcontinental railroads that received millions of acres of federal land to support their construction. The other side of the story, however, is that hundreds of local train lines and two transcontinentals, the Great Northern and the Milwaukee Railroad, were funded and built purely with private capital. So, when the Union Pacific and Northern Pacific Railroads lobbied Congress after the Civil War, contending that only government could help them complete their transcontinentals, they were wrong. James J. Hill soon built a more efficient competing line without government aid, and so too did the owners of the Milwaukee Railroad. Private roads not only survived panics when subsidized roads failed, but the owners of unsubsidized lines also spent their own funds to relocate farmers, future customers, along their routes, to invest in agricultural research and livestock breeding, and to ensure that the lines, once completed, would remain healthy. And it's worth noting the private companies, on their own, arrived at a national railroad track width standard without any involvement of government, universally agreeing to the 4-foot, 8.5-inch standard by 1886. In 1883, railroaders held a convention in Chicago where they adopted a system of standard time zones for schedules that is still in use today. The government did not make the time zones official for another 35 years. Transcontinentals provided countless benefits, ending the isolation of many Westerners and providing them with metropolitan corridors. Life was better with easier travel for visiting friends and relatives and leisure destinations, as well as for conducting business. In thousands of Western towns, the railroad station became the hub of community life, where locals eagerly awaited the daily arrival of freight and passengers, and the railroad's telegraph office became a vital link to the outside. Before radio, Westerners gathered around radio telegraphers to learn presidential election results, international news, and even the scores of football and World Series games. Railroads also contributed to the rise of America's national parks, as America's first generation of eco-tourists booked passage aboard special spur lines created by the Great Northern, Northern Pacific, and Southern Pacific Railroads to tour Glacier, Yellowstone, and Grand Canyon national parks. Railroad entrepreneurs like Henry Villard, in fact, plotted the routes of their lines to showcase the West's majesty. And when buffalo became a major attraction at Yellowstone Park, park officials attempted to ensure that passengers could see the buffalo herds from the train. The Natural Resources Frontier. Trends seen in the evolution of natural resource extraction industries, fur, fish, ore, timber, ranching, and agriculture, actually parallel several of the patterns of the stagecoach, steamboat, and transcontinental railroad industries. Entrepreneurs tended to start out small, but larger concerns soon came to dominate, largely because technology and capital were necessary to efficiently harvest natural resources. An important result of this efficiency, however, was a tendency to over-harvest in the short term, a failure to conserve natural resources, which quickly produced higher prices and efforts to moderate extraction in the longer term. Although historians have been quick to blame this environmental waste and destruction on the forces of free market capitalism, once again the picture is not so clear. In opposition to laissez-faire principles, the federal government often played a major role in leasing or giving federal land to miners, loggers, farmers, ranchers, and fishermen, distorting incentives by making resources cheap that, had the market had its way, would have come at a much higher cost. Then, as today, federal and state governments, not market forces, regulated many natural resource extraction industries, and often did so poorly, actually undercutting market forces that would have adjusted prices and, therefore, supply. Contrary to the capitalist menace view of the environment and extraction-related industries, it was the existence of so much public land, the absence of private property, that was the main detriment to responsible stewardship of Western natural resources. As we have seen, fur trappers were the first to over-harvest public lands. The American Fur Company, which flourished under the often heavy-handed direction of John Jacob Astor, began diversifying into emerging industries. Before the British retreated to the 49th parallel in 1846, the Hudson's Bay Company was harvesting, drying, and pickling Western salmon for export to Europe. Following the Civil War, American entrepreneurs cashed in on the revolutionary changes brought by the invention of the canning process. Canned fish, especially salmon, reaped spectacular profits for large concerns like Hapgood, Hume & Company, which employed thousands of Scandinavian immigrant fishermen and Chinese cannery workers. Like the fur trappers, fishermen over-harvested the public waterways. As early as 1877, trap and net fishing had interrupted and stifled salmon spawning. At the mouth of some western rivers, the armada of fishing boats was so thick during the salmon spawning season that fishermen could literally walk from deck to deck over the hundreds of fishing boats. Industry technology was so efficient that it threatened its own long-term survival. In the case of fur and fish, the early American legal system had not yet developed appropriate ways to privatize property rights so that those responsible for using the resources bore the full cost. Often, industrial polluters would dump waste in streams and rivers without owning any more than a small section of waterfront land. Other industrialists, however, displayed much better stewardship. Frederick Weyerhaeuser and Gustavus Swift, for example, voluntarily monitored replacement of resources and pollution as common-sense responses to wise land management. It was simply good business to ensure a constant supply of one's raw materials, whether trees or cattle. The rush to mine the West's rich veins of gold, silver, and copper ore also brought technology, capitalization, and environmental waste. While the Civil War raged back east, miners fanned out to seek gold in the present-day states of California, Nevada, site of the famed Comstock Lode, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. Afterward, they tried their luck in Colorado, in the Black Hills of the Dakotas, and near the turn of the century in the newly acquired Alaska. Canadian gold rushes in the Fraser River Valley of British Columbia and the Yukon Territory saw similar patterns and usually drew the same multinational workforce. In the early stages, mining rushes were peopled by individualistic entrepreneurs, the fabled sourdoughs equipped with only a pick and shovel, a gold pan, a few months' grub stake, and a mule to carry it all to El Dorado. Very few struck it rich, and most prospectors soon gave up and moved on to better pickings. Some took advantage of collaborative efforts to strike it rich. Groups of miners replaced single panning with rockers, sluice boxes, and long toms, with which they channeled fast-moving river water to strain dirt and more efficiently search for gold. The crude sluices, however, soon gave way to hydraulic mining, the use of powerful pumps and water hoses to wash down and cull entire hillsides in search of ore. Hydraulics of this magnitude required capital and expertise, which brought large companies and professional management and mining engineers. This evolution was completed with lode mining, the use of dynamite and rock crushers to separate veins of gold, silver, and copper ore from hard rock buried deep within mountainsides. By the time lode mining had begun, the sourdoughs and their sluices had long departed, and many of those who had come west to strike it rich found themselves working for a paycheck in company towns like Butte, Montana, or Globe, Arizona. While gold fever was claiming one sort of western immigrant, the thick forests, rich with spruce, cedar, pine, and Douglas fir trees, were beckoning another type, the logger. Although the Hudson's Bay Company had built a major logging and sawmilling operation in and around Fort Vancouver in 1827, smaller entrepreneurs also flocked to the West, drawn by the sheer abundance of natural resources. Western loggers followed water routes, floating timber down navigable rivers leading to sawmills like those at the mouth of the Columbia and Sacramento Rivers and on Puget Sound, Port Blakely and Port Ludlow, Grays Harbor, Washington, and Coos Bay, Oregon. The railroad's need for hundreds of thousands of railroad ties provided an important early market. This small-scale, decentralized logging business was revolutionized in the 1880s with the introduction of the narrow-gauge railroad, which made it possible to cut forests far away from navigable rivers. Innovations such as cross-cut saws, donkey engines, steam loaders, and steam-powered band saws, which could increase mill output tenfold, dramatically changed and improved the ways loggers felled, loaded, and processed timber. These were all capital-intensive technologies, which meant that small entrepreneurs soon gave way to larger, better-financed firms like the St. Paul and Tacoma Lumber Company and the Weyerhaeuser Company, which themselves had started small. Weyerhaeuser himself went broke in 1857, but soon tried again. His genius lay in his ability to see the final product and to understand the business concept of vertical integration, whereby the company owned all the various parts of the production process, from raw material to transportation to sales. By 1885, his Beef Sow Company processed some 500 million board feet of lumber. At that point, he still tended to use the forests as if they were infinite. But in 1900, having purchased nearly 1 million acres from the Great Northern Railroad, Weyerhaeuser's inspectors found that the lands were not nearly as rich in timber as he had thought. That discovery forced him, as market forces do, to focus on reforestation, preventing soil erosion, and on fire prevention. Then, as today, more forest lands are destroyed by fires, most caused by lightning, than are lost by harvesting. The historian of fire in America, Stephen Pine, found that from 1940 to 1965, when fire prevention techniques were far more advanced than in Weyerhaeuser's time, lightning started some 228,000 fires in the United States, burning up to 1 million acres in a single forest. Weyerhaeuser and soon other paper giants like International Paper and Kimberly-Clark began massive reforestation programs in which the companies planted on average about 5 times more than they consumed. Kimberly-Clark in 1902 became the first producer of paper products to embark on a long-term woodlands management program, employing hundreds of professional foresters before the U.S. government entered the arena of forest conservation. Whenever possible, of course, companies sought to use federal funds and federal lands while leasing and harvesting as many state and federal tracts as could be acquired. Interestingly, the Weyerhaeuser Company's ultimate dominance of Northwestern logging, the company owned 26% and 20% respectively of all Washington and Oregon timber stands, was an indirect result of federal largesse. Frederick Weyerhaeuser bought his Northwest empire at $6 per acre from his St. Paul, Minnesota neighbor, James J. Hill. Hill had obtained it when he bought the extensive federal land grants of Henry Villard's bankrupt Northern Pacific. Weyerhaeuser proceeded to build the world's largest sawmill in Everett, Washington, in 1914. A much different industry developed on the plains, where, from 1865 to 1885, the West witnessed the rise and fall of the cattle kingdom. Prior to the Civil War, when thousands of cattle populated the Texas plains with ranches stretching into Oregon and California, ranchers had shipped cattle to New Orleans. A special breed of cow, the Texas Longhorn, derisively referred to in the East as 8 pounds of hamburger on 800 pounds of bone and horn, could thrive on range grasses without additional feeding. And those cattle proved especially resistant to the ticks that carried Texas fever. Ironically, however, the resistance to the fever made the longhorn a dangerous presence in the East, where the ticks fell off and soon infected other non-resistant breeds, leading to an almost uniform quarantining of Texas longhorns prior to the mid-1860s. Then, by accident, drovers found that freezing temperatures killed the ticks. If a herd was held over on a northern range during a frost, it could be tick-free. Joseph G. McCoy, the founder of the town of Abilene, Kansas, was among the first to appreciate the benefits of both Abilene's cold weather and its location. He encouraged ranchers to send their herds to the Kansas Pacific Railroad's railhead in his town, which offered transportation to eastern markets. Jesse Chisholm, C-H-I-S-H-O-L-M, not to be confused with another cattle trailblazer, John Chisholm, C-H-I-S-U-M, cut a trail from Texas to Abilene in 1867, the Chisholm Trail, with his cowboys driving some 35,000 head north in the first year alone. More than 2 million cattle came up the Chisholm Trail during the next 20 years. Cattle barons like Charles Goodnight and Oliver Loving established their own well-worn trails for getting herds to the railheads. Boom towns sprang up to accommodate the cattle drovers as the railroad lines extended westward. From 1865 to the 1880s, the cattle frontier was in its prime. Ranches such as the King Ranch and the XIT Ranch covered thousands of acres, and tens of thousands of cattle arrived in Dodge City every year during its heyday, in the process creating one of the most thoroughly American figures in history, the cowboy. There was something special about the American cowboy. Everything from his clothing to his entertainments to the dangers he faced seemed to represent both the best and worst of young America. Typical drives lasted weeks. During that time, upward of a dozen or more cowboys spent every day on horseback and every night on hard sod with only a saddle for a pillow. Meals came from the ever-present chuck wagon that accompanied the drives, and they usually consisted of beans, bacon, hardtack, potatoes, onions, and whatever game might be killed along the way without spooking the herd. The wagon master drove the chuck wagon, cooked, handled all sewing and repair chores for the cowboys, set up and broke down camp, and when necessary was doctor or vet. Any cattle spotted along the way that had no visible brand were immediately roped, branded, and inventoried into the herd. Cattle required water at regular intervals, and the trail boss had to make sure he did not misread a map and cause an entire herd to die of thirst. Indians or white squatters frequently had control of strategic watering holes, for whose use which they extracted a hefty tribute from the desperate cowboys. Once the herd reached the railhead, the cattle went into stockyards to await trains to the Chicago slaughterhouses, while the dusty and thirsty cowboys took their pay and visited the bars and bordellos. That was what, on the surface, appeared to make the cattle towns so violent, a combination of liquor, guns, and men nearly crazy from the boredom of the drive. Yet outside these railhead towns, and excluding a few of the episodes of gang-type violence, the numbers of capital crimes in the West appear to be well below current violent crime rates, so the Wild West was only moderately more violent than the rest of society. Historian Roger McGrath studied the Sierra Nevada mining towns of Aurora and Bodie, which had more potential for violence than other Western towns. There he found that homicide rates were high, especially among the bad men who hung out at the saloons, although the homicide rate was about the same as in modern-day Washington, D.C. Yet he also discovered that virtually all other crime was non-existent, certainly due in part to the presence of an armed populace. Robberies in Aurora and Bodie were 7% of modern-day New York City's levels. Burglary was 1%, and rape was unheard of. Another study by Robert Dykstra of five cattle towns with a reputation for violence, Abilene, Ellsworth, Wichita, Dodge City, and Caldwell, discovered that the total cumulative number of homicides was less than